Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore, and in this episode, we're going to explore campus master planning with some of BSA's higher education experts. Our guests on this episode are Jeff Lyle, Josh Feld, and Steve Brubacher. Jeff Lyle is a principal at BSA and has been with the firm for over 25 years. Jeff earned his Bachelor of Science in Architecture and a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Design from Ball State University. Josh Fell is the Director of Design at BSA and graduated from the University of Utah with a BS in Architectural Studies and a Master's of Architecture. Prior to BSA, he worked as the Higher Education Practice Leader for Perkins & Will. Steve Brubacher is a principal at BSA and AIA and LEED AP certified. Steve is located in our Austin studio and received his Bachelor of Architecture from the University of Texas at Austin. Steve has 25 years of experience and has been with BSA for over 7 years. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I love the idea of bringing on our thought leaders in a roundtable kind of format and kind of bouncing around the room on different topics. So I appreciate you guys doing this. Scott had joined me earlier in the year and we talked about the future of learning and discovery. We talked about some of the challenges related to evolving learning models, space utilization and optimization, student engagement and well-being, along with community integration. So with that in mind, let's kind of jump into some discussion points around campus planning here. How has campus planning changed in the last decade?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, campuses have been kind of making bigger moves for the last several decades. There was this push to get parking sort of out of the internals of more traditional campuses. Campuses that live in more urban environments are trying really hard to sort of make it feel like a place versus just a collection of doorways along a street. And there's all these other layers that have kind of landed on top of that. There's a whole infrastructure conversation that happens at the campus planning level. There's strategies around resilience and sustainability and restorative landscapes, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, at the end of the day, what I find is sort of the common thread between all of it is trying to make sure that they're creating a really strong sense of place for their students, because that's how students feel connected. And when they feel connected and like they have a sense of belonging to an institution, they do better. You know, they have better graduation rates and retention rates and all that good stuff.
I think over time, a lot more universities have been looking at how can they get more out of older buildings? How can they, before they just tear them down, how can they, because it's harder to get money.
Right.
How can you reuse or make sure you've vetted all your options and reusing facilities the best you can, only making sure that whatever you put up gives you that level of flexibility or resilience. So to me, flexibility is more short-term ability to be able to make changes without a lot of cost, but the resiliency is, will the building hold up over time and allow itself to be able to without a lot of cost?
It is very expensive, obviously, if it's still a new building.
I'll mirror a lot of what Jeff said. I think it's just a look at a lot of flexibility and resources and resiliency and adaptability of those resources. Or, you know, they understand now that things are going to change. Things will change, and they want that designed into their new resources so that, you know, they have that built-in flexibility for the future.
Oh, 100%. I always try to think of it like this. There's places on a campus and specific buildings for specific uses that used to do one thing every day of the week, and now they have to do 10 things. So the rhythms of the day change how a building functions on a campus and how it activates the whole scene for their students and their faculty, researchers, and their staff. It's kind of exciting, you know, because it allows us to think about things in ways we haven't always. I think about the Anahis Gym, you know, that you were largely responsible for, Steve, and, you know, what a great example of taking something that was a thing and is now completely different. And I'm going to guess that the churn that goes through that place day to day, week to week, in terms of what they're working on, the robotics lab, all that stuff is probably constantly evolving through every semester.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's more share. It's more, and I know, Steve, we talked about at one point, some territoriality between different people and how people view their spaces. Mm-hmm. And I know I recently had a question about why is it an advantage to be two different departments in the same building? To me, it was more, you get more for less.
Right.
I mean, if you're able to share the spaces between the two departments, then each department gets a little bit more in the end.
So is that hard to overcome that territorial kind of mindset? That, like, this is my space. I don't want to share it with anybody.
Maybe 20 years ago, maybe is a more of a challenge. Nowadays, I think people are more open to it.
It depends a little bit on the institution. But the culture of each place is unique. It's funny. I had a client years ago. We were talking about office space, and that's the third rail of higher ed, right? Because office space tends to be pretty underutilized as a number of hours per day. And he kind of explained it to me. He said, look, I don't have a lot of control over how much I can pay everybody that works in my department, but I could offer him an office, and that's seen as like a real perk. So when you start having conversations about how that might change, or you might have to share, or you're going to work in a space that's sort of like, you know, show up and find a spot to sit, that doesn't always land right. But I think when clients sort of understand that they can get more we space for less me space, then they start to get it. And then it's like, okay, I'm getting all these other things.
I like that phrase. Mm-hmm. So what's been the impact of hybrid learning on space utilization?
Good question.
I think you get some spaces require more. For example, active learning spaces require more square foot per student than you would in a traditional classroom setting.
Right.
And depending on the type of labs or interactive type programs you want going on, you're going to require more space needs are going to grow.
Okay.
Yeah. I've kind of seen it really in a pointed way in the health sciences education realm recently. Lecture halls have always been kind of part of the equation, but many lectures are broadcast either live online or they're recorded for consumption that one at a time makes sense. And I had students that said, look, I'm sitting in this 300 seat lecture hall. There's like 30 of us in here because another 150 people are going to watch it later, and I don't want to be in a room like that. So the investment, you know, has changed a little bit. It's like, maybe we don't need giant lecture spaces as much, and we can get into more kind of detailed, focused, almost lab environments, I'll call it. I'm thinking about like health education does a lot of simulation, and having more of those resources for students so that they can engage in the kinds of activities and work that they're studying more regularly versus the old sage on the stage model of teaching has been, you know, a benefit to them. Like, I think students, they really engage with that and they connect with each other. There's kind of this sort of ideal size group that comes together and forms a unit, and those folks support each other through their educational journey. And that always has a really positive impact on their outcomes.
I think similarly, you get a lot of, again, rooms and classrooms and things that can be used for now a variety of purposes, right? You're no longer maybe having to have that huge lecture hall for a classroom. They could use a smaller collaboration room or conference room or something like that that could now be more of that kind of larger classroom space to a certain extent. I've also seen in some cases where they'll use those larger classrooms almost like a soundstage because there's no one there. They're using it more for creating that online course or creating content that can be consumed outside of that normal class hours.
So Josh, you'd mentioned some of the different types of ways that in a classroom, the information's being shared. Some of that, obviously, technology. So I'd like to ask you about the role of technology now in modern campus design. How do you guys account for it? Like when you're laying out a space, a classroom, an active learning space, how are you accounting for some of the new types of technology that are out there?
It depends a little bit on what the actual technology requirements are. Some are really specific. If you think about, I guess, more typical audiovisual delivery, that's a few things. There's microphones and cameras and you know, large monitors or screens involved. Simulation environments are a very specific thing. So there's a level of two-way communication and sort of the observation of things and the capture of things. And a lot of that stuff ties together in lots of really intricate ways. So I think that the strategy has always been get the backbone of infrastructure in there the right way. So as those things evolve over time, it's easy to sort of plug and play. It's gotten simpler in the last few years with fewer kind of dedicated, specific connections, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the other thing that we tend to run into at times is if there's a completely new way of delivering information, we have to sort of anticipate that that's going to come along.
that can be challenging, especially if an institution hasn't thought through where they're headed with that. If you've got a really strong, IT is not really the right word, but like, for instance, right. Auburn University has an entire department that's dedicated to how they teach. And they have an experimental lab where they can try out new technologies and see how it works and see what they need and kind of work out some bugs before they come back and say, okay, now we want to sort of transfer these spaces over to this delivery model.
Interesting.
It's, okay. It's everywhere. It's not going to go away.
Do you have to do testing in some of these buildings and rooms for Wi-Fi?
Well, I know we worked at Purdue. They come in and do a survey of the building at the end, and they step through that survey. They establish whether they're putting in their Wi-Fi ops.
Okay.
To get the amount of coverage they want.
Right, right.
For example. So,
yeah. They're going to be dead zones.
Those are all play into the whole bigger picture.
Okay.
How that plays into probably not only in the buildings, but adjacent spaces or outside, I'm sure it's part of the discussion.
Interesting. Steve, I know you've worked on some adaptive reuse projects. We've had you on to talk about them in the past, and Josh alluded to the AnaHIS project. But how do you balance historic preservation with some of those modern needs?
It's always a careful balance. You have to have an understanding of what's the historic significance of that particular building and what features are considered significant or character defining mm-hmm. for that particular building. Always kind of having those open discussions and discovering where you may have more leverage to introduce modern features or more flexibility in the visual language of usually the interior, but maybe even on the exterior. And then where can you introduce those features? Generally having kind of a light touch and respecting that original building and just being very careful where those modern features get introduced. A lot of times, things like modernizing windows and things to bring things up to energy code are always kind of, I wouldn't say easy, but things that are always possible with buildings of those age. Roof replacements, again, another item that typically comes up. It's also understanding who's going to inhabit that building and their needs, mm-hmm. making sure that those get accommodated. And sometimes that can really inform where and how things get done. AnaHIS is one example, right? That was a group of robotics researchers, and they're tinkerers, and they like to get in and mess with things. So they were really open to seeing all this infrastructure.
Right.
So we didn't have to try really hard to hide a bunch of stuff and maybe make things maybe stick out that didn't look in place with the original. So we didn't have to be that polished, right? We could let things kind of be what they were, and they were okay seeing that. That may not be maybe in a school of fine arts. They may not want to see that, right? They want mm-hmm. a little more clean and polished for a nice, maybe studio atmosphere. So it's really understanding all of those aspects and just kind of being very careful and having a light touch on those existing buildings.
I would add to that, the infrastructure part of the equation is usually the toughest one. Most buildings of historic significance were put together at a time that didn't really have to consider mechanically driven HVAC systems and really complicated plumbing, and getting that stuff sort of inserted in the right way can be a little tough. Floor to floor heights are sometimes an issue. Just finding places to run it is the challenge. So having a really clear set of rules for those systems, I think, helps go where Steve was talking. So that you kind of, you preserve the integrity of what's valuable about it. Sometimes the space needs are also a little bit in conflict with an historic building. Many historic buildings were sort of built around a collection of small rooms. Sometimes the program says, we need bigger rooms, and that doesn't always play well. So, you know, you got to be really careful in terms of your planning strategies and just be thoughtful about it. There's usually a way to solve it, and if you do it right, then it comes out really well.
Yeah, you're probably trying to avoid some load-bearing walls and things like that, right?
I mean, it's
the same with modern housing, right? Our homes have gone from cut-up small rooms to somewhat larger, and so that makes a lot of sense as you're talking about that. Josh, you've mentioned living learning environments in the past, I think even on the podcast, but also just to me in general. What about the integration of these living learning environments?
Well, it's interesting. As living on campus has become more normalized in the last few decades, and in some cases, you know, it's a requirement, and for good reason, because students that live on campus tend to do a lot better. They have better graduation rates, better retention rates. There's been a focus on, like, can we bring students together around a common purpose? And usually that's kind of built into the residential model, but they've started thinking about, well, how do we bring some of the teaching to the students in that world? Is there a cadence during the day when having instructors on site that students can engage with outside of a typical classroom where they're kind of mixed in with all the other students? Having that there makes for a very rich environment. And the thing that you'll tend to see is it sort of breaks down the conversation around where's the right place for housing on a campus. There was a time when, and this is often the case, every time they need to build a new housing residence hall, they look for a greenfield site because it's really hard to take beds offline. So it's like, well, if we can build it over here, then we can kind of take that one down and renovate it. And so campus housing was sort of drifting to the periphery of many institutions. And that drift sort of took a critical mass of students away from the center of campus. And you're seeing some of that kind of come back in, having the place where students live sort of deeply intertwined with the day-to-day activities of the broader campus in general has made for a really rich environment. I think of places like the Lassonde Studio Housing at the University of Utah, where it's all about bringing entrepreneurial business students together. And putting them in a place where they kind of have tinker space and maker space and places where they can work on a startup, et cetera, and putting that on display for every other student that maybe doesn't live on campus to come see and experience in a daily way.
Hey, you talk about that. I have a daughter in college now. And like you said, just being on campus, being there, creating community in a way. So how do you build community through intentional design? I mean, is it as simple as, like you said, trying to get people more to the center of campus, or are there other tools that you guys use?
There are some things that are about the physical environment. And I always say this about campuses, the spaces between the buildings are probably more important than the buildings themselves, because that's where everybody sort of interacts in the greatest densities. But in all honesty, the thing that matters the most is kind of thinking about what a student needs. It used to be that you would go to the bursar's office to pay your tuition over here, and then you'd head up to the hyper complex for all your phys ed kind of stuff, and then you'd head down to the quad where the chemistry building is, and you kind of move all over the place, and counseling was over here, this was over there, and the student was sort of moving everywhere all the time. And I think the non-physical thing is sort of bringing what students need kind of to them in a more convenient way, and then sort of freeing up real estate for other things that are about engaging kinds of activities. I've spent a lot of time in the student union world, and that's essentially the function of that building on a campus. It's a place to bring students from every discipline and every course of study together around activities that help them understand the world in bigger, broader ways. It kind of teaches them a lot of soft skills, which I think is really important. So there's a physical component to it, and then there's kind of an administrative or like a bunch of choices that have to be made. I guess the kind of like a simple way to put it is, when you think about designing places for a campus, whether they be outdoor spaces or particular buildings, it's kind of like we're designing verbs now, not nouns. We're not designing a lab. We're designing a place where people explore. Right. So we're not designing a lounge. We're designing an interactive space. Like those kinds of things just shift your mindset a little bit. And I think that is important in the whole flexibility and adaptability conversation too.
I think there's been more, I guess, thought and purpose behind some of these spaces than there have in the past. A lot of times it was like, we've got this program, we've got this scope, we need these spaces, we're going to get them all in the building, and where the students go is just, they'll figure it out. But then they realize that that's not really working well. Hallways may be overcrowded outside of classrooms and areas like that, or there's no real spaces for students or others to gravitate towards and sit in between classes or get some work done in between different sessions and things like that. So I think I've seen more recently that there's just more thought of where that happens, what those spaces are like, rather than just thinking, oh, well, the undergrads, they'll find a spot in the basement and make it work. No, they actually want a spot where they can sit for an hour or two, get some work done between classes, or meet with other classmates to go over notes and things like that. And I think it's just been a much more purposeful thought process and making that an attractive opportunity for the students. rather than just kind of leaving it by the wayside and you know, letting them figure it out.
I mean, I think it comes back to what people said about space between space and how do you use those areas to your advantage? How do you make them active versus inactive? How do you make it a place the students want to use? Because everyone wants different kinds of spaces. Everyone's looking for different things and what they're comfortable with.
Right.
And having the variety is good, but ties into getting the most out of what you have available to you.
Hey, let me just throw one more thought in there. There's a lot of research that suggests that having enough space outside of a formalized learning environment in a more informal way is incredibly valuable. So to Steve's point, thinking about circulation as more of a place to sort of come out of the formal learning environment and engage with another student for a few minutes or your instructor, professor, whatever, and ask a clarifying question or three. And it usually happens in short bursts. There's like this kind of 10-minute window.
Right.
It makes a huge difference in how students are kind of taking that information in and absorbing it and kind of internalizing it. There's some folks that would say, like, if you think about the formal learning environments as a certain amount of space, think about the informal space as at least a third of that. And to Steve's point before, like group study rooms, you couldn't build enough of those things. They're, students are constantly looking for a place to get together in groups of four to six or whatever, because that's where you kind of cement the ideas and learn from each other.
Let's talk a little bit about sustainability and some of the strategies that you guys incorporate into campus planning.
Well, there's so many layers to it now. I mean, some projects on a campus they kind of start out trying to solve a very pragmatic problem. Years ago, a team I was working with was doing some work at the University of Arkansas, and it was literally about ADA upgrades to their campus infrastructure. So like they didn't have proper slopes and ramps and everything from certain parts of the campus to other parts of the campus, and they needed to fix it. It's a broad reaching project, and they kind of realized that, well, in this particular part of the campus they were concentrating on, they also had an issue with flooding. About once every 3 to 4 years, they would get some immense rainfall and they'd have all these issues that they'd have to quickly contend with. And there was damages and all that kind of stuff. And they realized that putting those two needs together could solve the problem kind of in a final way. And so that was a real resilience strategy for them to say, let's take these ADA upgrades and let's look at our ground plane and let's try to deal with some of the things that have been vexing us for decades. And then other institutions, I think, are starting to look at sustainability as an activity at the beginning of a design process. So they look at the entire site. What are the opportunities that are available and what fits within the budget? What can we do to create maybe something that is a learning moment? Some of these restorative landscapes are really interesting. And there's nothing that kind of warms my heart more than seeing a bunch of botany students like walking around and sort of pointing at things and talking to each other about the stuff they just learned in class. And there's tons and tons of layers to it. I think at the end of the day, it's sustainability is a thing that we've talked about a lot, but really what it is, it's a holistic view of what it is that we're trying to accomplish and what's possible and what's feasible. There's always a moment to kind of step back and say, are there things we could be doing in maybe a little bit different way? Maybe they're cost neutral. Maybe there's a cost premium. Maybe they're actually a cost savings, but that makes for a better, more restorative environment.
That's a good way of putting it, because I think it's across the board. I mean, it's not just about what are you doing with your plantings or your irrigation systems. It's about all kinds of things on the campus and taking advantage of opportunities, looking at problems that you're having to solve on your campus and how can you solve the problem, but maybe you can use that to solve several other problems along the way. And also looking at not just what you're doing on your rainwater management or things like this, but also when you go to, is the building reusable? Is it not reusable? To what extent is it reusable? Are there opportunities to, by giving yourself a little bit of different perspective, apply a problem or solution in a way that addresses multiple issues and gives you a better place in the long-term picture?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like the work you're doing at Research 2 at Notre Dame, Jeff, I mean, I think that's a prime example of kind of zooming out a little bit and looking at the site in a different way that kind of shifted the way that Notre Dame might have approached their ground plane from years before. It's a very formalized series of quads, et cetera. And that kind of thinking is really just, it, you just have to make room for it. And when you do that, then you get really interesting results.
Stretch the boundaries a little bit.
Well, Jeff, you've worked on several projects on the same campus. I mean, multiple campuses, but specific to a singular campus. How do you work to manage campus density and growth?
Interesting. Well, when we work on projects, I mean, most campuses we work on have some level of a master plan component that exists within the campus that they use as a reference as we move forward. And you're trying to balance that master plan against the needs of whatever the project or the challenge is in front of you. At the same time, realizing that there's a short-term view, a long-term view, because most of these campuses have been around for 100 plus years, and they will continue to be around long after we're done. And space is finite. It's not, you know, magically recreating itself. So how do you get the most out of that space that's available to you and meet some of those goals or those needs that master plan that the campus has set up? You start to look to kind of some of the points we talked about earlier, context. What is that context you're working in? What's that campus identity that is important to the university for either their identity or their cultural direction or the students that are using it? What makes it important to them? And you're kind of doing the balancing act across the board.
Right.
So, I mean, we're seeing our small window in time. You know, we can see where they've been since their inception.
Right.
And we're seeing our window. And then where it may be going down the road is a different question. So you're trying to look ahead, get out your magic eight ball and see if you can see the right direction. But you do your best.
It's just, I get this visual of like a music producer adjusting levels, right? Mm-hmm. You've got this switchboard and you're trying to, all right, let's look over here and adjust this.
Jeff, one of the things that I thought was so striking about the Wilmoth Active Learning Center at Purdue was kind of the change to the way that that end of campus felt. I mean, literally, you took the spot of an old power plant, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then you really changed the way that that part of campus was connected to other parts of campus. And what that does is sets the university up to better utilize the assets that they have in terms of land or other buildings and get it all connected in really meaningful ways. I mean, it was such a wonderful transformation from, I think, they had a road that ran through there. And I think I remember seeing photos of some Jersey barriers and things in time. I was like, it was not great. And now it's kind of awesome. That's a
good point. It was a pivot point on that campus when they got rid of the old power plant. And with the new building there, it does kind of serve as a focus point for that area, but it also sets up a pivot point from what there is more of their historic mall to a newer direction mall, sets up a pivot point to a new quad that's coming up to the east of the building. So it does help set the stage for things to happen down the road.
So let's talk a little bit about how do you design for today's student expectations, meaning, you know, there's mental health, wellness, inclusivity. How do you work to incorporate those things?
Well, it's interesting. Students, they have such a different mindset than when I was in college a billion years ago. And I always think about the book that Thomas Friedman wrote. I think it was called The World is Flat. And I think this came out in like 2010 or something like that. He sort of points out that like before I wrote this book, if you talked about LinkedIn, you would probably think of a prison.
Right.
If you thought about all the connectivity that students have, it was just such a different set of rules. And he basically makes the point that everything really changed the way students interact with each other and many others, you know, things like social media, the sort of the convenience of Amazon and delivery model, sort of the Starbucks coffee third place environment. These were big things, but all of that changed in like 6 years.
Yeah.
Like it didn't exist and then it was everywhere.
Right.
And that has really changed students' expectations. I mean, they're so connected. It's as easy for them to talk to a friend across the world as it is to talk to somebody across the hallway.
Right.
And they do. So you kind of have to just understand that the expectations and the needs are going to be ever evolving. And in addition to that, you've got to sort of tap into what gets them excited. Like there's got to be more to the world than locking yourself in your residence hall room and kind of chipping away at social media. So some of it's about drawing them out and giving them some new expectations that maybe they didn't think they had.
Yeah. Is this where some of the esports stuff ties in? I mean, you've got a whole generation that loves playing video games, but if you can get them together, it's going to bring them out of their shell a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that was always kind of the mantra of every residence hall director that I worked with. It's like, I have to find ways to get these students out of their rooms.
Right.
So the focus was really like, let's change the expectation of what they're going to have day to day from a personal compartmentalized space to a series of social interactions outside of that. So that sort of was the birth of the kind of community kitchen as a teaching environment, but also a hangout thing. It's no longer just a little room on the side of a hallway where you go heat up your top ramen or whatever. It's a place to really bring students together and focus their energies and connection.
Well, I think the students are going to gravitate toward those active spaces. I mean, you can go to most campuses, Purdue, and you can see the old buildings that were done in the 30s or 40s and long corridors and single doors in the classrooms. And usually sometimes you'll have a bunch of people sitting on the floor waiting for a class outside.
Right.
But once those classes are over, there's no one sitting in the hallway anymore.
Right.
But if you go to like Active Learning Center or whatever, some of those places that have accounted for that level of interaction, and not only provide for the interaction during classroom, but when they're outside the classroom, have spaces that they can continue to have that interaction.
Yeah.
And they don't have to leave. And I thought Josh had a good point about the fact that you can communicate the same way to the guy in the room next to you as the guy that's in England right now.
Right. And I want to stay on this for a second because, Josh, you brought up the point of it's changed since you were in school. There's a lot that's changed in just a 15 to 20 year span from an interaction and a technology standpoint. So do you survey the students? How do you come across some of this research to know what's in their minds right now?
Oh, 100%. Like the engagement with students on a particular project is one of the most valuable activities you can do. Now, there's always a component of leadership that needs to come from within the institution. But sort of mining through what's on their mind and what they've been dealing with. And some of it's very pragmatic, but some of it's not. That becomes a thing that really sets up some important drivers, the things that we would call success factors.
Well, speaking of success, I'd like to ask each one of you about some recent success stories from projects where you overcame a challenge, maybe provided an innovative solution, or learned some lessons, if you will. So, Steve, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. I think one of my more recent ones, when we were designing the Anna Hiss gym for the robotics faculty, the real important aspect was that every space, every area had to be open and flexible because the research changed so frequently and so fast. They needed that ability to be super, super adaptable to that kind of changing environment. So we had these huge gym spaces, and we had one area that we wanted to make sure that was kept wide open, high ceilings, clear floor space, all of that, because they did robot soccer, right? So they needed a big field. So how they worked all that out, we're like, okay, so we were very careful at that end of the building, making sure that all worked out, but maintaining that may not be there forever. Well, maybe 2 months after they moved in, they converted that whole area into a big drone space because I guess robot soccer wasn't nearly as important as that drone research. Heading up and had all of this just open airspace. So that was just something at the time of design we never considered. That was not drone research, and all of that was nothing that was ever brought up or any part of what they were looking at. So knowing that we were able to design that space with that flexibility and adaptability, that they could very quickly and easily adapt it and change it for that research, was, in my mind, a huge success.
Yeah, it's fascinating, too. Only a few months had gone by, and then they've already converted
the
space.
Robot gym to drone.
Jeff, how about you?
I can think of a few, but let's speak to the Wilmoth Active Learning Center at Purdue. I mean, every job has its challenges, the things you're trying to work through and overcome and deal with. But in this case, we got rid of the old power plant, and we had a fairly tight site. We pretty much filled it up with a new building. But looking at the way the building was moving students in, we had 2,500 students on a class change coming in and going out. So you have a large group of people coming through the building on a fairly regular basis. How do you maintain that, not slow people down, allow that to happen pretty efficiently? Looking at how the spaces were organized, not just in a base plan, but three-dimensional chess, where the larger rooms are positioned versus the smaller rooms and how the people have to move through the building. Looking at the codes at the time that were available to us and how we could, some code strategies and how we could approach the building from that movement and yet keep the building very open,
right.
Not make it feel enclosed, not make it feel too tight, mm-hmm. if you will. And in the end, I think our biggest success in the sense that we had criticism that the building wasn't big enough.
Oh, really?
In other words, it's too busy. Everyone wanted to be there. So I'm like, well, that's great. We should build another one.
Right.
But it was a building that really, really was, by its nature, became so successful that everyone loved being there.
Everyone wanted to be there.
The complaint was, I can never find a spot because it's always busy.
That's a good thing.
So yeah. I thought that was a good thing.
Josh, how about you?
Good question. I guess maybe I'd kind of go to the Education Innovation Center that we recently completed for Wake Tech.
Yeah.
During the early planning phases, the client was kind of thinking, it's got a certain number of classrooms and labs, but there's also a good amount of kind of soft space for students. There's a small library component, a little bit of food service. It's the first building on a new campus. So it's really setting the stage for what that experience is going to be. And it had to do a lot of things. But in those early discussions, they were thinking about their classrooms in kind of a pretty traditional way. It's like, it's built around 24 to 30 students. And they're connected with a corridor that's double loaded. For those that don't speak architect, that means, you know, there's doors in and out of classrooms on both sides. The hallways can be kind of long. The class change issue is always an issue. You want to sort of avoid the students sitting on the floor with their legs out,
right,
having to be stepped over and all that kind of stuff. But in addition to thinking about that, they were really concerned with some of the security issues that have really become more prescient over the last couple of decades. Like what happens if somebody shows up on campus and with the intent to do ill harm to their students, and how do we contend with that? One reaction might be, well, you sort of harden all the spaces so that you can defend in place and things of that nature. The resolution we came to was, hey, maybe rather than thinking about it as this long double-loaded corridor with teaching spaces on either side, maybe we think about it as a racetrack where we kind of push the classrooms together in the middle and create circulation around and between things so that students have a choice when they exit the classroom. But then the conversation was, well, really like having windows in our classrooms. We had some that were on the short ends that absolutely had direct daylight, but others that were inboard. And we said, well, let's figure out a way to borrow light through the exterior wall.
Mm.
And the net result was we found a way to sort of solve a very difficult pragmatic problem, or at least make it better in terms of students have a choice in terms of how they're going to circulate out of a building in an emergency. They can't get necessarily pinned in one place. But it also made for a much better connection in their social spaces outside the classroom to the campus. They set it up around a new green space that's really important for the organization of their future buildings, and they really wanted a strong connection to that. And I think the best part of it was seeing how you can experience that at your own leisure anytime throughout the day. And it's not just available when you're actually in the classroom and, quite frankly, trying to be more focused on what your teachers and instructors are presenting to you. So that was a fun moment. And then kind of weaving in the celebrating vertical circulation. Jeff did that at Wilmoth, making sure that the big stairs in the middle encourage people to use them. And it's a place to sort of gather and anchor everything. It was really good to see how that worked out at the end of the day.
Yeah. And for our listeners, a lot of these projects I'm going to link to in the show notes that we've been talking about so they can get some more information on them. What emerging trends are you guys seeing in the higher education design space?
Well, I mean, we're seeing some projects that are looking more toward integration of some work experience, partners in the industry,
okay,
that have spaces within the buildings that allow for students to interact with those partners in different ways. So we're seeing some of that as far as how we're kind of spaces we're being asked to provide,
mm-hmm,
and how we're being asked to set rooms up to allow some of those activities to occur. So that's one of the things that I guess we're seeing.
The sort of the engagement with the broader community has become a bigger part of the conversation. I think most of these institutions understand that they live in a place where there's other things that go on besides what they're doing, and creating that connection has become maybe more top of mind. That town and gown relationship has come to the forefront. And I think, to Jeff's point, students, I think, feel really connected, not only to their institution as a campus, but also in many cases to the cities that these places are in. you probably not find anybody that went to Purdue that doesn't have a love for the city that it sits in, what's Lafayette. There's all the things about it that create for a rich environment. And I think the trend is to sort of embrace that and leverage those things together.
It's interesting.
I've seen a lot of focus lately on kind of on the student experience in general. There's a big push to attract and retain different students, faculty, and staff. I think there's just a lot more competition in that realm between different universities. So they're trying to really upgrade their facilities and new facilities that really have that aspect to them so that there is something there that just attracts the student body in general.
Yeah, that's absolutely on the nose there, Steve. It's interesting how many conversations have sort of focused around, I've got to upgrade this facility so that I can attract the researchers that I want because it impacts the programs that we're going to be doing and the things that we can teach. And then we get better instructors and better faculty, and it all compounds that way.
Lastly, I wanted to ask, in your opinions, what is the most important consideration for institutions planning campus updates to consider?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have a really clear vision of what they want to accomplish. That vision really sets the tone, and it uncovers a lot of things along the journey.
Yeah, having that vision and understanding where your campus has been and where you want it to be going helps set the stage for some of those decisions you're going to make as you work forward.
But we really need the folks in place to sort of say,
absolutely,
those decisions are valid.
Yeah, I would say long-term adaptability and resiliency. They really need to plan for and accommodate for change. It's inevitable, and it's going to happen. So plan for it. You'll be ahead in that.
I want to thank you guys for coming on. This has really been a great conversation. So thanks.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Jeff, Josh, and Steve again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. In the show notes are links to several of the projects Jeff, Josh, and Steve discussed, including the Wilmoth Active Learning Center at Purdue University, AnaHIS, and the Wake Tech Education and Innovation Center. If you're interested in learning more about BSA and our expertise, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes also to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.